Welcome to Rogue Reporter with Jazzy Notes, an audio history by Ed Arno in conversation with daughter Do Arno Hayes. Based on Ed's memoirs by the same title, it was recorded in a series of sessions in early 2012 in San Francisco, California. We begin now with Chapter 1, The Lucky Break.
Okay, well, hello. I'm glad we're able to do this.
Do, whatever prompted you to want to do this recording?
Well, I remember sitting and talking to you and hearing these stories even before you wrote this memoir. And I was always so fascinated and interested in the stories. And they make such a wonderful, I mean, it's great to read them. They're written very vividly, but it's so much more fun to hear them. So I always wanted to do the oral history. You tell a good story.
Well, thank you very much. You're opinionated because you're my daughter.
Perhaps. Talk about what you call the lucky break and how it changed for you in broadcast news.
To put this in perspective, I was a writer for announces at KMBC, which now has the call letters of KNBR, NBC's owned and operated radio station in San Francisco. I was a news writer.
This was the building on Taylor Street?
The building on Taylor Street, 420 Taylor Street. I remember it vividly, and so does my wife. That's where I met her. Anyhow, in those days, there were writers and readers. Newsmen wrote scripts, news scripts for announcers to read. And that was my job. I worked an eight-hour shift, and all newscasts that occurred during that shift, I wrote. It wasn't a big operation. There was a news director and five of us reporters. Well, four. One was an assistant news director. On this particular day, a plane coming in from Australia hit the mountain on its way into a landing at SFO. What we didn't know at the time but found out later, one of the 19 people aboard the plane, that includes passengers and crew, all were killed, and one of them was a very, very famous young rising pianist, William Capel, whose stature was equal to Van Cliburn at the time. You get a plane crashing into a mountain, coming into an airport, it's a major story. And Bill Carthren, who was the assistant news director at KNBC, called me. I wasn't due in to work for another hour or two, I don't think. But I was all dressed, and he called me and told me where the crash scene was and said, can you get there in a hurry? And I said, I'll try. I got up to the point. I knew that area pretty well because where I lived in Woodside was about 30 miles south of San Francisco, and I could take either Bayshore Highway to get into the city or, if I wanted a more scenic route, go Skyline. And this was on Skyline, where the rescue party assembled to get into the crash scene, which I'm guessing was something like a mile and a half or 2 miles in through just terribly vicious terrain. I got there, and a couple of cameramen, one from the Redwood City Tribune, and I think the other one was from AP, arrived at the scene at the same time I did, and we went in with the rescue party, and they sealed off the area after that. No one else was let in. We went over this treacherous area and got to the plane, which was still smoldering, and nothing but death and destruction. We turned around and got back out. The Redwood City cameraman lost the camera down a ravine because he had to grab onto something to keep himself from not going down the ravine. And I got in my car and raced to the city. In those days, as a writer, I was the one, because of my shift, that wrote the inserts for NBC's prime newscast, network newscast of the evening, Morgan Beatty's News of the World. And standard procedure, when we had a story, I would write it and an announcer would read it. The way this worked was they would switch from New York to San Francisco for this minute and a half insert live, But the network had to be switched in order for reversed, in order for San Francisco to feed to New York, who could then feed the nation. There was a 4-second delay on this reversal of the network. We all operated on this. We knew it. We knew we had to count it. And this was standard procedure. We'd been doing it all along. Beatty would switch to San Francisco with a preset cue. In San Francisco, I would wait in a booth and count out the 4 seconds and give the cue to the announcer to start reading.
And who was the announcer then?
Oh, it was Joe Gillespie, Ed Brady, John Glover, Clancy Leisure, Hal Wolf, the whole slug of announcers. There were more announcers than there were newsmen. And I got into the studio from the plane crash, and Catherine said, Beatty wants to talk to you. So I called him, and he said, Ed, do you realize who was on that plane? William Capel. I said, yeah. By then, I did realize it was all over the wires. And he said, this is an eyewitness account. I want you to do the story. I couldn't believe what he was saying, but that's the way it was. I was to do the story. I prepared my minute and a half, just as I would have if an announcer read it, except this was all first person. I went into the booth, no one giving me any cues. I had earphones on, and Beatty said, and for that story, we go to San Francisco and Ed Arno. One, two, three, silently, four. And I started talking. I managed to get through that broadcast with a lot of tension in my voice. It was a tragic story, so it was okay. It only added a little drama to the report. And that was that. I got through it and lost 5 pounds in sweat. I was terrified. Mike Fright.
I find it amazing that you were that nervous.
Well, Mike Fright is a terrible thing that gets a majority of people. I don't know that it's true anymore because of television. And I can't really explain that one. But it happened to me, and I suffered with it for 6 months.
Really?
It took me to get over it. And I just plodded through every broadcast I had to do and did it. The only broadcasts I was doing then were for the network, not for the local station. I would do the inserts on the World News Roundup in the morning if there was a story that warranted it. There weren't that many stories out of San Francisco that warranted it. I would do the Beatty thing. We called that show Beatty's News of the World, the Alk, because it was sponsored by Alka-Seltzer, who also sponsored One Man's Family, which immediately followed the Alky newscast, all produced by Miles Laboratories. Alka-Seltzer for the smile of health, Sal Apatica for the smile of beauty. I also was doing inserts into the 5-minute news on the hour. Late at night.
Writing them.
Writing them and voicing them. It was the network. The network approved me, not the local station.
So after that first on-air broadcast that you did, they said, that's great, we want you to keep doing that?
No, I didn't hear anything more for 6 or 9 months later, when, as I understand it, NBC was contemplating expanding the concept of letting the newsman read his own material. Correspondents overseas were doing that all along. Obviously, they had to. They couldn't set up an announcer setup. And plus, which these were all important people who were the network foreign correspondents. But they didn't do it in the States with the likes of us. NBC decided to expand the concept to the States and try it with 3 people, one in Washington, one in Chicago, and one in San Francisco. I was their only man in San Francisco at this point. Washington was David Brinkley. Chicago was John Chancellor. They went on to big, big times. I was in the sticks. I was in Indian country. And, you know, I have stories to say this. Literally, they thought I was in Indian country. You know, some of the guys on the desk in New York.
You did obviously eventually get over the mic fright.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it was a slow process, but I did it. And I was terribly concerned about how my voice sounded on the air. I'm a kid from the Bronx, talk sometimes like a kid from the Bronx, and that doesn't go well. As an aside, NBC always wanted to have a voice that could reach all of America. At one point, this was discarded early because it was so preposterous. They actually sent a memo to all the correspondents and reporters to sound as much like David Brinkley as they could.
Really?
Everybody rebelled. And, you know, David Brinkley sounds like David Brinkley because he's David Brinkley. And every one of us sounded different. And, I recognize voices all the time of people on the air because they're distinctive. I had a distinctive voice, too, but I wanted it to be a little better cultured. This was in the early days of recording. I had a recorder. I would take newscasts, five-minute newscasts, the AP and UP would turn out for the announcers to read on stations that didn't have reporters rewriting or even scanning the news. The announcers became the newsmen. And I would take them home. It was written for broadcast. And we'd read countless newscasts into a tape recorder and hear the playback on them. I didn't want anyone else to criticize these playbacks. Nobody ever heard them except me and Joanna, your mother, listening to how I sounded and how I could make corrections, what I should beware of, words to be careful of, how you pronounce them. And that went on for a while, and it paid off because my voice improved, my air voice improved.
Well, yeah, I mean, you ended up having a career in radio. So are there any big stories that you can think of in the early days? You mentioned when Khrushchev came to San Francisco.
The Nikita Khrushchev episode took place in 1959, Khrushchev came as a guest of the United States State Department, came to America, and one of his stops was in San Francisco.
What was the purpose for the trip?
Goodwill. I don't think there was anything more than repaying a visit that our president made to Russia. These were not so exciting Cold War days. It was a little better at the time. Obviously, when Khrushchev went anywhere, he had a big State Department entourage with him. Henry Cabot Lodge was with Khrushchev, and he was with the State Department at the time. And he was with Khrushchev when they came to San Francisco. And a big, burly guy, and boy, he pushed the reporters out of the way to get Khrushchev through the mob scene, trying to get him aboard the Coast Guard cutter where they were taking him out on the bay for a tour of San Francisco Bay. The way the press was handled on this was they simply designated pool correspondents. There was one from the wire services, one from radio, one from the New York Times. There were just a handful that were permitted aboard this thing. And Brinkley got the radio assignment.
He was in town for the story.
He was traveling with the group. He had no interest whatsoever in going out on a boat ride with Khrushchev on San Francisco Bay. And he didn't like the idea of reporting pool for everybody. And he said, I don't want this damn thing. And I said, I'll take it, David. And he handed it to me.
I'm amazed by that.
And that's how fast it happened. There I was standing close by with the NBC gang.
It amazes me that he would rather be on the receiving end of pool coverage than be the person with Khrushchev providing the...
Going out on the bay didn't appeal to David Brinkley. Going on a boat ride with Khrushchev, he didn't expect anybody was going to get near Khrushchev on the thing.
And did
you? Amazingly... Khrushchev was standing out there on the deck with his interpreter, and I walked up to him with a tape recorder and said, I'd like to talk to you, sir. And the interpreter interpreted what I said to Khrushchev. Khrushchev answered, and we started talking.
Do you remember what you talked about?
We talked about a lot of very soft things, like what was his impression of California driving up from the airport. And he said he was very jovial. This is a very warm, friendly conversation we were having. He said he was just amazed at the automobiles with only one person in each of them. And he said he saw many interesting things, and then we just chatted. That broadcast ended up on the network, on a lot of people's networks.
Oh, God.
And it was all so strange. It worked for me. It was a feather in my cap.
NBC Monitor.
NBC Monitor was really, I would say, the high point of my career in radio. Monitor was a program that NBC broadcast on weekends. It started early Saturday morning and ended late Saturday night. Nothing on it lasted more than 3 to 5 minutes. It just was a jigsaw. They covered everything. They went worldwide. They went for natural sound of things. They put on stupid features. They put on a lot of serious stuff. They had segments called Emphasis, in which correspondents around the world did a 5-minute think piece on the area of the world that they were covering. They had entertainment interviews with all of the celebrities they could nail. They covered sports with interviews. They did a lot of hard news, news on the hour. For NBC started at that point. That's where it started, was a Monitor. I was in San Francisco as the network person, and I got along fine with the producer and assistant producer of Monitor in New York. I started doing things for them and started doing more and more things for them. I was in a unique position. I was the person in San Francisco, the one network person in San Francisco. Therefore, I was in the position to assign stories for Monitor. And a show like Monitor would eat up material all over the place. There was a lot to do. And being the person who could assign who could cover what, I assigned myself. This got me a lot of work. I was doing sports interviews. I was doing entertainment interviews. Anybody of any value with an entertainment name coming anywhere near San Francisco got hounded by me for an interview, all of which was broadcast. I did entertainment, sports, hard news, and think pieces. As such, I think I was the only person feeding Monitor who was doing all that, everything. The consequence was I became one of the major contributors in the world to NBC Monitor. I had more stuff on the air over the long period of Monitor. It was on the air almost 10 years.
Wow.
I had more stuff on the air, traveled all over the world to do things for Monitor. Monitor got the assignment, the 1960 Winter Olympic Games, as the network person.
Up at Squaw Valley.
Up at Squaw Valley. CBS had the radio and television rights. And so NBC had a back door to the whole thing, and it wasn't that big for NBC, but they had a cover. They had me, Jay Miller, who was another very frequent contributor to Monitor out of Tucson, Arizona, who figured out how to break Monitor. He was in a position to sell, and he was a good salesman. Jay and myself, I think there was one other person whose name escapes me, were the only people at Squaw Valley for the 60 Olympics. Local radio covered, all kinds of other kinds of coverage, but we were the network people. Because I was the network person, the network got to me to handle the arrangements for for coverage of the 60 Olympics. I was assigned by them to go up there and find a home that could house 14 people, which included the television crews.
Wow.
I went up there and found a great spot looking down on the skating arena. It was a long walk down on the road, but I had snowshoes. You could go down the slope directly to it. My first experience with snowshoes.
Were there more?
But, But it was Monitor that sent me there. And when the Summer Games came up in Rome, it was Monitor who sent me to Rome to do the Summer Games. Like, again, Jay made it there. I don't think it was anyone else but Jay and me in Rome.
So all the world travel started because of Monitor.
Right. There were other things that were going on. To backtrack just slightly here, I was employed by KNBC as a news writer. As all this developed with the network, the KNBC got into a snit about the whole thing. John Thompson, who was the news director at the time, was fairly well thought of within the NBC hierarchy in New York. And Thompson was moved to Los Angeles to head up the NBC operation, news operation there. And during this quite long period of time, after I did the first broadcast on the plane crash, things slowly developed with me for the local station, and I did have some broadcasts locally. I did a commentary, international politics commentary, along with Ed Radenzell, who was the Wire editor, foreign editor at the Chronicle at the time. And we did a 15-minute commentary separate every other day. It was the two Eds. Radenzell would do it Monday, I'd do it Tuesday. He'd do it Wednesday, I'd do it Thursday. He'd do it Friday, I'd do it Saturday. We rotated and talked about world affairs. I also started doing some local broadcasts. I became the Richfield Reporter, which was a local thing. Which
sponsored by Richfield? Was it
Richfield Oil, ARCO. The Richfield Reporter on radio was big-time local radio. And at some point, I inherited the Richfield Reporter. So I was doing some things locally, but not an awful lot. The key reasons for the sudden switch from me being a KNBC employee to a network employee occurred because of one of the assignments that KNBC had concerning receiving the reports from correspondents overseas in order to relay them to New York for the network newscasts. This was the time of the Korean War.
Oh.
A lot was going on the Pacific. My job was to come in to the station if there would be something, you know, from the Far East, from Korea or from Japan or from the Philippines or Australia. My job was to come in at 3 o'clock in the morning to the station. And for some reason, New York couldn't talk directly to the correspondent, but I could on shortwave radio. My job was to talk to the correspondent, get him up, discuss what was in his report. I had better access to the wire services than he did. He'd want to know, was there anything on this? Nope, nothing on that, Charlie. It's that's still hanging. And we would kick it around for a while, and he'd have his broadcast ready, and he would deliver it, and we would record it in San Francisco on an acetate disc. We had a recording studio, and the only way you could record was to do it on a disc. And the disc was then played back to New York when we had closed circuit time to feed.
Right.
But if we fed it on a closed circuit to New York, they didn't have to do that.
They would delay it. They would broadcast it.
They would broadcast it. And this was all done, we're talking about short time, a half hour from the time I took this broadcast in, it would be on the air in New York. So
it was
it
a short turnaround.
Live,
right.
It was
a
quick, almost live.
But they would take it in and turn it around and feed it back out on their broadcast.
Yeah. But my job was to be the liaison with the correspondent anywhere in the Pacific. And KNBC charged NBC, the network, even, you know, this is all internal. KNBC is owned and operated by NBC.
Right.
But KNBC on the books would charge the network for the engineering time, for my time, inconvenience, whatever. The recording, there were a lot of people involved in this 3 o'clock thing. The network decided they wanted to charge for this. There hadn't been a charge before. So all the things I was talking about were things that they now wanted to charge, and the network balked there was a great deal of animosity in certain departments, both on the network level and on the local level, between local and network.
It sounds like they were almost feeling like they were in competition with each other.
Everybody's trying to be a little better than their boss, smarter. Well, John Thompson, who was the news director at KNBC when I first went to work there, had been transferred to L.A. and was news director now of the whole NBC Network Los Angeles operation. And Thompson got me on the phone one morning and said, "Ed, how would you like to work for the network instead of KNBC?" He said, "You're working for us. That's all it means." And I said, "Well, it's a step forward as far as I can see it. Sure." KNBC got angry at this whole response. Me being removed from their payroll and put on the network payroll.
But you'd still be working at the same facility.
Still working, except they gave me a hole in the wall, KNBC did, to operate from, which also was an engineering studio. So it worked for me. I didn't need much space. The general manager at KNBC at the time rebelled against this and said, "I'm going to take it out of your hide, your news hide." They laid off everybody in the newsroom and gave the job of reading news to the announcers to simply rip and read, as we called it, the five-minute summaries that came in on AP or UPI, or in those days there was INS as well. It was UP that later merged with INS to become UPI. We had all these wires, ticker tape machines going in a room all set aside to itself, tearing away. Constant news that the announcers would simply rip and read. Mm. They didn't. Some of them were very conscientious and did know what they were doing. Some of them couldn't care less. "You want a newscast? There's a five-minute newscast. I'll read it just the way it is."
Oh my God.
So they wiped out the newsroom. They were no longer going to give them any kind of news service, and they were going to degrade news. That enabled me to have the heyday of Monitor because I had no time commitments other than that 3 a.m. lousy time thing. And I even worked a way to get out of that half the time. I had newsmen from San Francisco covering for me who would meet the circuit. I would pay them out of my own pocket. I paid any number of people. I finally ended up, I had taught a class in broadcast journalism. I had these people that I could rely on who were competent. Bud Liebes, who went on to become the dean of the journalism department at San Francisco State, was a copy reader at the Examiner at the time, coming off shift at 2 a.m. I had trained him on how to do it, and he had access to the building. You get in and out of that NBC building, anybody could, at any hour of the day or night.
That's funny.
And I finally ended up hiring a student of mine. I had taught a class in broadcast journalism at the Stanford Broadcast Institute in those early days, and the class was conducted at KNBC. This student, his name is Bob Goggin, was hired by me and put on a permanent salary. And the way I could afford this thing was I could arrange for him to do monitor spots. So, and there were big after fees connected with anything that you did on the network. Bob did very well with my basic salary that I gave him and the money that I helped him earn. And he was with me for a long time. Jeez, it must be something like 2 years.
Wow.
Goggin worked for me. Till the network found out, who is this guy, Bob Goggin? After a long while, it really was a long while. "Hey, who is this Bob Goggin? He's my assistant. Who pays him? I do. We can't have that." So he was put on the payroll of NBC.
Which is better?
Oh, sure. He got a decent salary. I was paying him marginal money and assuring him that I would see to it that he made a decent living with broadcast fees.
This concludes Chapter 1.